Okay, thanks for coming and for the invitation to give a talk here. You might have realized that the title has changed from Gauss's law entanglement to emergent Gauss's law entanglement, and this is actually important. And the reason is very simple. So all the things that I'm going to talk about in this talk, we'll assume that there's a tensor product Hilbert space structure. So if you have like a say you declare your Hilbert space to be a gauge invariant subspace, then this my argument will not work. Maybe it does, but not in an obvious way. Okay, so just keep that in mind. This is not because I am not interested in those. It's just that I cannot simply make any useful statements in such theories. Okay. All right. So before I start, I want to first discuss what I'm not going to talk about. It's going to be very quick.
So, yeah, this is a very large set.
One of the things that I'm not going to talk about. So in two-dimensional theories, 2+1, there's this famous paper by Kitaev, Preskill, and Levin and Wen. Who declared that if you have a smooth boundary, a region of which I denote as A, and if you calculate the entanglement entropy of this region, it scales like this. So this is some non-universal term that is proportional to the boundary area, and this is a universal contribution which is known as the topological entanglement entropy. And there's a rough intuition on how this works. So imagine you write down the density matrix of the system. And just write down its eigenvalue decomposition. Roughly, and if you look at each of these eigenstates, then you have to realize that if you have some conservation law, so that if you can define a notion of charges, since you calculated this reduced density matrix from the ground state, for most of the states, if you imagine inspecting each local regions and measuring the charge and adding them all up, they will have to fuse to the identity charge. And this gives you a non-trivial constraint. And that's why you get this negative contribution, because you have less states than you would naively think you have. So this is not what I'm going to talk about. Today, what I'm going to talk about is that I will assume that there's some notion of Gauss's law, and I'll also assume that there's some notion of tensor product Hilbert space structure, and from that, I will derive a non-trivial constraint on the ground state entanglement. Okay? So, before I begin the actual part of my talk, let me first briefly discuss why I want to do this. The first reason is because I think it is conceptually nice. Hopefully, I can convince you after the end of the talk. But secondly, it actually sort of predicts some new potentially universal contributions to entanglement entropy, which, to my knowledge, has been studied so far. So it could be an interesting problem to tackle these things. And there are two actual candidates for this. So one is 2+1D scale invariant theories. And the second example that I want to discuss, if I do have time, will be the interface between two different topological phases. Okay, just to be clear, in the second one, the first one, it just means that I have gapless modes moving around. In the second case, what I mean is that imagine you have a very large system, and here you have your topological theory 1, and here you have a topological theory 2, which may be different from the topological theory 1. A very simple example would be having a toric code here, which is a Z2 gauge field, which is a Z2 gauge field, and here, imagine you have a vacuum. And then I want to say somebody gives me the ground state, and I want to declare that there is some domain wall between this region and this region by looking at the reduced density matrix of this region. So it turns out that one can derive obstructions using the method that I'm going to describe. Okay. So the way I want to do this is that first I want to do this one and go through the actual derivation. At the end of the, after I do the derivation, I want to discuss the intuition behind this. The reason why I make this unusual choice was because the intuition is actually not a physics intuition. It's one of those things. If you know it, it's very simple. But if you don't know it, it takes time to learn. And it's an information theory intuition. So I will assume that's not the typical knowledge of this audience. But the upside is that the derivation is quite simple. And I only use very simple tools, which has been used a lot in this program, namely the strong subadditivity of entropy. So let me first state the result. So suppose you have a ground state of a scale invariant theory in 2D. And imagine you have a sphere with diameter L and L, with separation OL. And say you calculate the mutual information between these two guys, which is this one, by definition. And then I'll derive a lower bound on this guy based on two constants that I define as C prime and C double prime. And as I go along, I will define what these things are. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the assumptions that goes into this actual work. As the title suggests, I will need to assume two things. First, is the formulation of what it means to have a Gauss's law. And the second part will be the scaling form of the entanglement entropy. So first one, Gauss's law.
Sir, what is your result there? You have an upper and a lower bound of that form?
No, just a lower bound.
A lower bound?
Just a lower bound. I don't have any upper bound.
Okay.
Yeah.
Question? C prime and C double prime can be zero?
Yeah, they can be zero, yes. So so this is a little hard to define at this moment. This can be thought as the following. So say you have a scale invariant theory, and say you have a sphere, A. There are scale invariant theories now that are not conformally invariant in 2 plus 1, and those guys can potentially have a log term. And the coefficient in front of that log term is actually this guy. Okay. So first, I want to find what it means to have a Gauss's law. So say I have things like lots of spins on this two-dimensional lattice. And with the lattice spacing A. And I want to look at some annulus. Let's call it as A. This annulus will have a width, which I call as W. And its radius would roughly be in the order of okay. And these will be my assumptions. First of all, I will assume that there exists this thing that is called as a string operator. String operator is a unitary operator that creates a particle-antiparticle pair and moves them around and puts them in different locations. For example, if I want to put a negative charge in the interior of this annulus, I will assume that there exists some string operator that puts a negative charge here and a positive charge here. And I will also assume that one could equally create the same state by applying another string operator, which picks up and ends at the same point. So this is what I mean by a string operator.
So those create the same state?
They create the same state. This is my assumption. Oh, by the way, so along the way, if you find any of the assumptions unreasonable, please let me know, because if they're not true, then obviously none of this will actually make any sense.
But let's say in a Z2 gauge theory.
Right.
Well, so if you thought about QED, you could create a particle, an electron here and an electron here, and there are different ways of routing the electric field lines, and they would be inequivalent states that they would create. So at least that's an example of something that doesn't satisfy the conditional.
So you have an so what is the state in this
just,
case?
Just
so
the choice of where you put the Wilson line.
It's just the choice of where you put the line.
It
matters.
It does matter. Ecology. Yeah, for there are different radiative contributions to the field, basically.
And the commutator with the electric field is different depending on where you put the line. Right?
That's another way of saying it.
Then that doesn't require an topology to be a true statement.
Yep.
Okay. So. Okay, so I guess they're
topological.
Okay, good. So that's
in the topological theory, there isn't an electric field.
Different
field, so that's how you.
Okay. And in the second assumption, I want to assume. That there is a sort of a flux measurement operator along this annulus. I'm not going to actually construct this operator, but what I want to assume is the following. Suppose I create this state, which has a charge E in the interior and minus E in the exterior, and charge E prime in the interior and charge E prime in the exterior. It's the same region despite what it looks like. And I want to assume that in the limit that L goes to infinity, I want to assume that the reduced state over A that is created by first creating such a state and taking the partial trace over this interior and exterior region is orthogonal to the state with a different charge in the limit that L goes to infinity. So this is where the name Gauss's law comes from. I mean, at least this is a motivation for me to put the name Gauss's law in the title, which is the fact that there exists some flux measurement operator. Even if I don't know what the flux measurement operator, I think it's reasonable to still say that these two states are orthogonal in the limit that L goes to infinity.
Why do you need L? I mean, in a gauge theory, if you have different charges, then the states are simply orthogonal and you don't need L goes to infinity, right?
Yeah, but I'm thinking some, like, yeah, so, I mean, if L doesn't need to go to infinity, but I'm just playing my... let's say.
That's why it's emergent.
I mean, like, it could be, exactly. It could be emergent, so, like, it could be that the actual operator that measures this thing is kind of spread out a bit. Yeah. Just being careful.
So, does this matrix being lost to the product of the trace of the product?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. That's one way to say it. Yeah.
So, but just coming back, is it important that the theory is gapped or not?
It's not important.
But is it then important that some topological sector of it is gapped? Or?
I think that might come into play in the next one, which is on the entanglement, because if the theory is gapped or gapped, depending on whether the theory is gapped or gapless, you could have different entanglement scalings. So.
No, but you're using, you want to use this fact that the string operator is path independent somehow acting on the
gravity. Yeah. So if
does that occur for any gapless theories?
It's not clear. How do I get this? So if there is. It's not completely clear to me. Yeah. So now I want to discuss entangled entropy. So there's a lot of work in the literature about the entangled entropies in 2 plus 1 dimensions. I'm not going to write down all the references here, but I think the bottom line is this. So say you have a polygonal region like this, then the entangled entropy has the following form. So this is, again, the leading non-universal term, and this is the term that can be potentially universal, and also the constant and some small correction. And the point is, so generally, the coefficient in front of the log term has the following structure. So you might have this constant term. So first of all, if you have a corner term, then you always have this sum of contributions, which are coming from each of the corners. And then you have some extra term, C naught, which is independent of the existence of corner. If, for example, if you have a free Maxwell theory.
What are these functions? Are they generally are not known? With C as a function of
M? I don't think it's not known in general. In certain cases it is, but generally not, I think.
So are you asking if charges are localized?
Yes. Up to some exponential correction. I mean, so the important point is in this L goes to infinity window, so that it's well localized in some interior region.
Okay. I'm scaling by aspect exclude like three fermion, bunch of three fermion.
Scaling variance. Sorry, can you say that again?
So maybe you can think about one of these three fermion switch forms to the are these systems excluded from scaling volumes? Or what scaling volumes?
Well, I actually only need this entangled entropy formula.
Okay.
So I'm not going to explicitly use the scaling variance assumption.
So basically, that's the assumption.
Yeah, this is the assumption. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Are you assuming that correlation functions cluster?
Maybe not.
Okay. If you assume that, does C0 have to be 0?
Which one? This
C0?
One? C0? C0? Well, I mean, if you have a ghost, let's say you only have a ghost unknown, then this is not 0, right?
If correlation functions cluster, it is 0.
Well,
if you like put in a small symmetry breaking field and make the correlation.
I would imagine it's probably 0, but I'm not sure if there's an airtight argument that says that.
Okay, but you are allowing for.
Yeah. It could be 0. All right, so what am I going to actually derive? So I'm going to derive a constraint on the entangled entropy between these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 regions, which will be translated into something that involves C's and D's, and those things will be related to basically the number of possible fluxes that can pass through a region of say size L. So let me first write down what I will prove. and then let's see how that actually works out. So I have this huge region called A, but it's important to remember that the length scales of each of these regions are still order L. Maybe this is like a 1/5 of L, and maybe this is like 1/10 of L, but it's still order of L. And the result is the following. So the left-hand side, n is the total number of different possible fluxes that you can measure along this annulus. And on the right-hand side, what you have is the linear combinations of ground state and tangent entropies. And if you have thought about strong subadditivity long enough time, you would realize that the right-hand side is actually right-hand side being larger or equal to zero is actually equivalent to the strong subadditivity. So if you just look at this thing, you might wonder, wait, isn't this stronger than strong subadditivity, and as such, may be wrong? And the answer to this is that's not quite what's going on. And the reason why we seem to get a stronger inequality than the strong subadditivity is because we are not applying the inequality to the ground state alone. We're actually applying to an ensemble of states, which could potentially sometimes lead to a better inequality. But the point is this. The point that I want to emphasize is that this is a quantity that is a priori not clear whether it is related to the... So this is the properties of the excited states, because this is a possible flux sectors that you can measure along this annulus. But on the right-hand side, we have a linear combination of ground state entanglement entropy. And this means that if the ground state entanglement is sufficiently low, you cannot possibly have too many different flux sectors that you can measure on the excited state. And in other words, the ground state entanglement gives you a non-trivial constraint on the excited states, roughly speaking. So,
And if the
So let me give you an example. So if you have a toric code, then N would be 4, because you have 4 possible super selection sectors. annulus would size it all. Yeah.
Sorry, so it's the flux going around the annulus or through the annulus?
Through the annulus, like this. In topological theories, this is simply the total number of super selection sectors. N is 4,
You have only ground 4.
Well, I mean, so for example, if you can have just identity charge or electric or magnetic or EM, yes.
So N is different from quantum dimension?
Yeah, it is different from quantum dimension, yes, in general. Although for abelian theories, this turns out the inequality is actually saturated with an equality. For non-abelian theories, in general, it seems that they're not equal to each other. Okay, any other questions?
So is there some relation between the right-hand side and the topological entanglement entropy and this gamma
right.
that you're not talking about?
I am not going to talk about it, but since you asked, I can talk about it, I guess. But for topological theories, it turns out that this is 2 gamma. So, So it's kind of neat. I mean, I didn't use any, I guess, when calculating this side, I did use topological quantum field theory, but this inequality itself is independent of topological quantum field theory. And somehow it gives you a pretty good bound.
And in that case, it is set. In that case, gamma
right.
is log of square root of the quantum dimension, right?
Right. So 2 gamma.
So 2 gamma is b.
Is log of.
These without guys. The square root, right?
Right. Sorry. Yes. Yes. So it gives you a very obvious inequality that.
And what is A in terms of the?
A is the. A represents each of the super selection centers.
What's N in terms of the D sub A?
N is.
Is there a formula with an equal sign?
No.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. All right. I'm not sure how to use this part of the board. Yes?
What do you think this is? If I go in 3 dimensions, again I can define both things, topological time entropy and ground state degeneracy, mm-hmm. or general dimensions. What is the general answer? Is it?
So you're asking about 3D, right?
Yeah, anything.
Okay.
We don't have to absorb
anything. Yeah, I mean, I can try to draw this. I'm not sure if I'll succeed, but. So this will be B, and. This will be C, and actually, it wasn't so bad. Yeah, this is D, in 3D. Yeah, with a hole. Okay.
And the C is inside the hole, or should one?
Yeah, C fills that hole. Yeah.
And B is on top.
Yeah, B is like covering this hole, basically. Okay. So, how does it actually work? I promise you that it was simple. I still think it is, but hopefully you agree with me after, say, 10 minutes. So the key point is this. So one thing that you might have naively expected would be to, let's just use strong subadditivity to ground state. And that sort of gives you some inequality, but it's not really good enough to get that. So what I actually do... is to consider this state. So what is this state, psi e? Right, this annulus. And imagine I create these charged and particle and antiparticle. And say this is the excited state psi e. This is the global state that we're going to use. And the point is this. I guess I made a really bad decision to like go all the way down here. The point is, you basically apply strong subadditivity to this state. what is strong subadditivity? It's this famous inequality that was proved by Levi and Ruska in 1972. And let's see what happens. So the part that I want to focus is this guy, the entropy of ABC. And I will claim that in the large L limit, where L is the length scale, this becomes log n becomes the following. It obeys the following relation. And why is that? First of all, I want to remind you that this state is basically created by just looking at one of the excited states, psi e, and taking the partial trace over the interior and the exterior of the exterior region. And one of the assumptions that I made here is that if you look at the state for a different charge, then they are almost orthogonal to each other, at least in the limit that L goes to infinity. So what it means is that all of these states are effectively orthogonal to each other. So if you actually write down this expression, imagine expanding all of these guys out. And the point is, if you look at this log, all of these are orthogonal to each other. So you can imagine writing down everything in some standard basis for which they are like obviously orthogonal to each other. And this means that you can reduce this expression to the following form, which in turn becomes the following relation. Okay, so far so good. And I want to use this inequality. So this has some aspect that we wanted, which is that we have this log n term, which is what we wanted on that side. But it doesn't have but it lacks one crucial property, which is that if you look at the entropy of ABC over, which is created by first creating a charge and particle and antiparticle and tracing out this interior and exterior region, potentially they may have a different entropy than the ground state and entropy. But it turns out that this can be actually remedied in a sense that you can actually upper bound this thing with some quantity that you can actually calculate from the ground state integrand alone. And after that part, it will be done. So how does this work?
So the ground state is one of the e's?
So it'll be equal zero, for example. So if you plug this thing in to that relation, this would be large or equal to log n. But it turns out that we can check later that there is a very simple inequality, again, just using strong subadditivity. That this thing is upper bounded by this thing. And the way you see this very roughly is that you first realize that each of these, the left-hand side and the right-hand side, both contains these two terms with the same sign, so they cancel out. And you end up having two positive contributions and two negative contributions, and you can compare with the strong subadditivity inequality and realize that it is indeed actually true. So you do some algebraic manipulation, and at the end of the day, assuming that each of SB.
Top line.
The top line.
Looks like
you yeah. SB. And here I actually need to use this controversial assumption that I need to use, which is that there exists a string operator, and as such, if you imagine creating this particle antiparticle pair this way, then and no matter what these charges are, if you look at the subsystem, say AB or BC, they will be identical. So for topological theories, this will be true. So it seems like for gapless theories, this may not be true. But even for gapless theories, you can still count such states if there exists any. I just don't know how to do it. But that would be the definition of log n. And under that condition, we can declare that the density matrix over BC for this state will be identical to the density matrix of the ground state. And that's where we get the final result. Any questions so far? So there were the game that we can play now is that we can basically plug in this entanglement entropy formula to this expression and see what happens. Let's try to do that. So these were our regions. And let's do it term by terms. So first, you look at this leading term, and let's see if they indeed cancel out each other. So first term, BC. And the next term. This has to be C. And we have CV term. And and if you look at the area law contribution, you can do this adding and subtraction game. So there's plus here, minus here. And again, you can do the same game here. So they're all canceled out. And you basically get the idea. And voila, it's zero. And you need to be a little bit more careful for the log term, because there are contributions which may not depend on the shape, and there are contributions that does depend on the existence of the corners. But our construction, the nice thing about our construction was that, first of all the angles are 90 degrees, so all we need to do is to just count the number of corners. It's too bad I actually erased all of these things, but we can do it fairly efficiently. So for BC, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 corners. And if you look at CD, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 terms. If you look at D and B, you can easily see that there's 8 and 8. So zero. It's important to remember this is actually not zero, because each of these sizes are different. So what you actually have is some residual order one term, which does not depend on L. But here's the point. Basically, if here we implicitly assume that B and D. So the corner terms do cancel out, but the important thing is this. So there might be some corner independent term, and let's say we have, let's assume that this is proportional to the number of connected components, which is not the case. But if that's the case, then you'll see that BC has one connected component, and CD has one, B has two, and D has two, so you get minus two. And that will need to violate strong subadditivity. And as such, we should realize that if you have two regions that are far away from each other, they will not just be a, this coefficient will not just depend on the number of connected components, which I guess Tarun and Max both knew some time ago. But anyway, so basically you can play this game over and over again. And so for gap theories, you get this inequality. For gapless theories, you need to be more careful, because you need to count the correct number of states. But there will be, I guess I have 10 more minutes.
15.
Can we actually go back?
Yeah.
I didn't quite follow how you got to the bottom.
Okay. So from here to here.
That's strong subadditivity.
Right, yeah.
So row here is that row.
Yeah, so this row is this row. And this is. Right. This row is the ground state row. And the reason why you get that is
bottom row.
Yeah, the bottom.
It's separate from the
yeah, this is a ground state row. Does that answer your question?
Well, it helps, but.
The reason why you get the ground state row here as opposed to that row is because we assume that if you look at regions like BC and CD, and E and D, we assume that all these excited states, even for all these excited states, their ground state reduced density matrix will be identical to the reduced density matrix for each of these states. And that's why you get the same entropy. So at this point, you should realize that this game is a pretty general one, and you could apply to a variety of systems. And I was thinking about going to the next example, which is two topological theories with gap boundary. So say you have two systems, topological theory 1 and then topological theory 2. And then you want to ask, and you're given a microscopic wave function. And you want to ask what's going on here. And you want to check whether there exists a domain wall, and if it does, then what's the property of this domain wall. And I won't be able to go through the details, but I will draw the analogous diagrams so that later, if you're interested, you can work it out. So this is the diagram. And it turns out that the equivalence inequality this n now has a different meaning. This is basically number of super selection sectors that can actually condense at the domain wall. From up to down. And if you think about it a little more, and if you, for example, if you want to study the other part, for example, if you want to know what's the total number, you can apply this in the other direction, and then you'll get a different diagram. But the lower bound is still intact. And to the best of my knowledge, this linear combination has not been studied. And when I did calculate this to a number of known models, number of exactly solar models, it seemed to be consistent with something that's known in the literature as this one. So let me explain what this expression means. So here, as I said, I am assuming that I have two topological theories. It's called the topological theory in the upper hand as C, and in the lower part as D. And this basically means the superselection sectors in the topological theory C. And dA is the quantum dimension of each of these super selection sectors. And W is basically, WA1 is the number of inequivalent ways in which this guy can condense into topological, into this direction, and annihilate on the boundary. And this object was studied, introduced, using one. And I don't know how to quite prove this for general theories, but I hope I could convince you that basically Strong's subadditivity gives you a very general and quite strong constraint on the ground state entanglement. But this doesn't come obviously because you need to. This doesn't come obviously if you only look at the ground state entanglement itself. You need to consider the states like this. And only after that you can get an inequality that seems to be seemingly stronger than Strong's subadditivity on the surface, but that actually gives you a tighter bound. I guess that's all I wanted to talk.
Could you repeat the conclusion for the first part? You trapping the entanglement entropy formula on the area of class, low area of class constants. Then you said there will be translation practice, and I couldn't get the final statement.
So the So the question is about the scale invariant theories, and you have these log terms, and the question is what the conclusion was. Right. So, So in those case, the conclusion was this. So, say you have two regions with circles. OL. This is equal to C naught log L plus this one, where N is the total number of different possible fluxes you can measure along this index.
That comes from this B, C, D, E. So you introduce this.
Right. So, yeah, so the point is this. So there was this, imagine doing this calculation, but you just say subtract D and add, subtract D and add D, which doesn't really do you anything. But what it does is that it basically gives you some terms that are order one plus a mutual information between these square regions. But the thing is, mutual information can only increase if you like expand each of these regions. So imagine for these two regions, imagine drawing a circle like this, which includes these squares. And then you do the rotational invariance, and then you get like two terms like this. And I think this is much weaker than I initially thought it was, because I thought this could give you quite a big lower bound, but apparently that's not the case. Only in topological theories, it seems like it gives you something non-trivial. Yes?
And C is just the coefficient of the log for a single circle.
That's right, yeah.
So,
yeah. This string assumption, you only use it, right, to show that these reduced density matrices are independent of your sort of charge superselection sector.
That's correct, yes.
So I don't think that you need that all strings are equivalent in some sense. All you really need, right, is the ability to add a string, say, on the left side of that diagram. It switches you from one sector to another, but doesn't change the reduced density matrices of B, C, B, D.
That's true, but I agree with that, but I don't feel that safe right now, because I want two choices of strings, say here, and it doesn't have to be these two, but it has to, let's see. So I need to assume that there exists at least two different string operators that creates the same configuration, so that one of them can pass through like this and the other can pass through like that. But is that possible? I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, it could be true, but I don't know if it's true in general. I certainly don't need like infinitely many different configurations to be all equivalent to each other.
Can you elaborate how you think that the inequality works in a Maxwell theory in 2 plus 1d? The one you just wrote with the two circles.
Maxwell's theory, two circles.
Yeah, just this IAB is greater or equal than C log L plus log N over 2.
Let's see. So I guess you already have this term, right? If you can draw these two inequivalent string operators that creates the same excited state, then you do have this. Then it becomes like this. But so for Maxwell theory, say you can create a charge in the interior region and its antiparticle in the exterior region with two inequivalent string operators so that they gives you the same excited state, then the lower bound becomes this one, log L divided by 2. But otherwise, I can't say anything useful.
So N now corresponds to putting some number of charges inside the region, or?
Yeah, so it's the, it's not exactly the number of charges that you can put in the region, because it's something that you can measure on the boundary, on the annulus, that can differentiate the different states. So the question is, you do something here, and locally along the annulus, you don't make any changes locally. And the question is, how many possible states can you have on this annulus, conditioned on these constraints?
So it's basically the number of fluxes you can put inside of that disk?
I think so, yeah.
But why is it L and not L squared?
Yeah, I guess implicitly I assumed that for unit boundary area, I guess I was kind of thinking that you can not put too many fluxes in this bounded area. But, I mean, if, it could be L square, but then the problem is this. So imagine I have a cylinder, and basically I can go through the same infinite cylinder, and I can basically go through the same argument, and then I can put infinitely many charges here. And in that case, it seems like the lower bound is unbounded. So this has to, so I kind of doubt that the lower bound be exactly the number of charges that you can put inside a region. Yes?
Sorry, I'm still a little confused. So if we just take a gap theory that's topological in the IR, your thing is supposed to apply to that, like your Z, right?
It's, yeah, assuming the entropy formula is correct, yes.
Okay, so C naught is zero there, right? Because there's no
C naught is zero, yes.
And then you had a log n over 2, and n is the number of flux sectors. Mm-hmm. But what I'm confused about is you're saying that basically, I mean, I thought that if you calculate the mutual information and L is much larger than the correlation, like you get zero.
Oh, so okay. So this, I'm basically neglecting the constant terms here. So there are like constant terms here and here. So here, so for critical theories, I was only interested in this leading log L behavior because I just wanted to say that there is an extensive amount of mutual information. I mean, like, so if you restore all these like constant terms, the inequality still works out. But you're just not seeing them in this form.
I see. So we're only interested in the kind of the log L.
For this case, yes. For this guy, no. In this case, we don't have any log terms, so we are actually interested in the constant term.
But I mean, I'm still slightly confused because your left-hand side is independent of the separation. I mean, you said it's order L, but it should go to zero. The mutual information should go to zero in any theory as I take the separation large. But here you seem to have like a lower bound which is actually growing with L.
Yeah. But the thing is this. So first of all, even if this term vanishes, you still have this lower bound by Strong's additivity. And secondly, these regions are simultaneously growing as well as the separation.
But what if we fix the size? So we fix L, but we just increase the separation.
Then I would imagine it would go to zero.
But your bound is like not allowing it to go to zero at least.
Well, in my bound, when I draw things like this, then I'm implicitly assuming that the radius of this guy is always comparable to their just separation distance. So I can't possibly get around with that. I'll go next. Yeah.
I have just one follow-up of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So if if I do the other case, I keep the infix and take them apart. Mm-hmm. So mutual information typically goes from power law. Can you constrain whether power law could be or could not be? Like how should it decay?
So if I know that the mutual information decays like a power law,
then there are some bounds on that coefficient of power law strong severity or.
I don't have any concrete arguments, but I do feel like these like long distance behavior will not give you too much about. Yeah, it's just my feeling.
And one more question about just that formula. Yeah. So there you related your bounding for motion and time entropy in terms of number of ground states on torus.
Right.
In this case, 2D.
Sort of.
But
yes.
If I go in 3D,
yes.
Exactly same formula cannot be correct. Because on T3, for example, you have 8 ground states for Z2 gauge theory, but gamma is still log 2. Mm-hmm. So,
I see.
So what is how does it work in high dimension? If I define N as number of ground states on TD, D-dimensional torus, then there must be some modification of this formula.
Let's see.
Because log of 8 is not less than equal to log of 4.
Maybe I can think about this more after this.
Right, because that seems like a ground state on maybe cylinder right now, because we are putting only one direction, like not in high dimensions. It's more like a.
I know what I should calculate, but I can't do the calculation in my head right now. Mm-hmm.
Let's check it.
I think probably I missed something simple.
Right, yeah.
So this inequality is supposed to be true for general state rather than that particular. Mm-hmm. So if I don't choose the metric but the one for state, the result will just be that.
It will give you a weaker bound. Like for example, it'll be like this is larger than 0.
But that means this bound is only true for this state.
Yes.
For
yeah. So I mean, yes. If you choose to state that way, then you needed the assumptions that I erased.
But the final result is for the ground state.
Final result is for the ground state. But in the middle, I need to use that state. Yes.
So the mutual information would also have a bound like this if you put a correlation function there instead of your log L. So is it possible that, there's some, I don't know, that you could find some local operator that would have this behavior that can derive your bound this way? You wouldn't be able to do that.
Maybe, but there's this like a famous, like really crazy states known as like quantum data hiding states. And these are like bipartite states for which you have like absolutely like almost vanishing correlation, but for any crazy operator that you can think of, but somehow you have a large mutual information. So maybe you'll never be able to get. It's logically possible for you to never find any like a simple correlation function that has this behavior.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you call the name?
Data hiding states. Data hiding. Quantum data hiding states. Yeah.
Any more questions? Wait, let's thank Isaac again.